I'm Bob Crawford, and as always, joined by Dr. Ben Sawyer. Ben, how was your trip back from Mexico?
It was the worst trip ever because it was a trip back from Mexico. It was so exciting to see how many people like the podcast and the positive feedback. And, you know, the thing about podcasting is we don't ever see you because we're on the other end of this microphone, but getting to actually speak to people, that was a really, really great experience. And I think that made this podcast even more exciting than it already was.
Yeah, it helped me to really appreciate how lucky we are to do this. And we're lucky to do it because you guys are out there listening to us and encouraging us to continue. So we will continue. And I'm excited to announce today that we have become a part of the Osiris podcasting family. Osiris is a podcast network started by RJB and Tom Marshall. RJ is the host of the Helping Friendly podcast, and Tom Marshall, you may know him as the lyricist for Phish, and he also has several podcasts that he's a part of, and the Osiris Network is affiliated and partnered with Relics Magazine, so this is a kind of a new beginning for The Road to Now and RTM Productions, and we're just really happy and thankful to be a part of Osiris. RJ, Tom, welcome to The Road to Now.
Hey, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It's super exciting.
So what led you guys to create this podcasting network?
RJ and I both have Phish podcasts, and his is called The Helping Friendly Podcast, and mine is called Under the Scales. And, you know, working together, we realized that there's sort of a need for music podcasts to sort of all be able to be discovered in one place. And as we kind of got a bunch of friends together, a lot of other people kind of like raised their eyebrows and said, can we join? And finally, RJ and I realized we kind of have something going on here. So that is literally the origins of it. We weren't really thinking of it as a business until suddenly it became one.
RJ?
One of the exciting things about having you guys on here is that I think this podcast, The Road to Now, is a great addition because it helps us, you know, all reach more people. And I think it's advantageous to all of our podcasts to have, you know, a broad variety as part of the network. And really, we're trying to kind of create a community and be the go-to place for music and culture conversation and commentary and music as well.
Yeah, and it was exciting for us because when you approached us, it just seemed like you have, you're at the core of what you were doing and now we are doing together is building community and helping each other out. And just helping good ideas get spread, which if anybody knows this, you know, when you start a band, when you start a podcast, when you start painting, sometimes it's just about finding the right people to support you and help people know what's going on. And so this is exciting that we get to be a part of this.
Yeah, it really is. One thing that we noticed both as, you know, we started our podcast and you guys did too with zero listeners. And it's a little bit tough. The ramp is steep right in the beginning for podcasters. And so this sort of strength in numbers approach that we've done immediately gives music podcasters a family. So if you have a podcast or you're thinking of doing a podcast in the music or culture realm, please go check out osirispod.com. And we're really excited that The Road to Now is our newest member. You know, I've been a fan of the Avett Brothers for a long time, and now I understand that you guys are Phish fans. That's just really cool. Really, really happy to have you on board.
Yeah, and I'm excited that you guys are associated with Relics Magazine because I've had some associations with them in the past, friends with Pete Shapiro. If anyone out there has been to a concert at the Capitol Theater in New York, you need to thank Pete Shapiro because he has kind of brought on a renaissance of that great music venue, and that's only the tip of the iceberg of what he's done in the music realm. So this is just for me. The idea of joining with you guys made perfect sense.
Yeah, and I would just say that Relics is, you know, they played such a big part in the live music community over the years. And I think that cool thing about our partnership is they see this as part of the future. And we're going to be collaborating a lot with them across all of our podcasts and the network.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. And let's call this the beginning.
Absolutely. We're so happy that we're beginning with you. And I should add that this is, you guys crept just under the curtain Before the Curtain Rises officially on Osiris on February 20th, 2018. So you guys are a member of the pre-Osiris launch family, and we're really, really excited that you guys joined us.
We're happy to be a part.
Thank you.
Ramza Records' David Childers reteams with producer Don Dixon for Run Skeleton Run. The lauded North Carolina singer-songwriter's latest effort features vocals and banjo contributions by Scott Avett of the Avett Brothers. Road to Now listeners can even get a 20% off discount on David Childers' new album by using the promo code HISTORY at RamzaRecords.com.
Okay, so on to the show, and in honor of President's Day, we had an interview with Robert Merry, one of my favorite historians, who wrote a book called The Country of Vast Designs about James K. Polk, one of my favorite books. He most recently wrote a book about McKinley, about President McKinley.
Architect of the American Century. Came out in 2017 in Simon & Schuster Press, so it's a pretty hot book. Maybe he's been making the rounds.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating because we are living in a moment where the face of the Republican Party and the ideology and the ideals of the party that have stood for almost a century, well, for since McKinley, they're changing, right? They're changing immediately from free trade to tariff. And McKinley was the guy who kind of ushered in the modern Republican Party that we knew of until Donald Trump.
That's right. And so it's really interesting to look at McKinley, who his politics will sound familiar to you because they're until recently, as you said, the GOP cornerstones, but he's the president who oversees this transition himself. So if you're interested in looking how parties transition and how leaders play into that, I think you're going to get a lot out of this episode.
Robert Merry, welcome to The Road to Now. It's a pleasure for us to have you. I'm a big fan of yours. Several years ago, I read In a Country of Vast Designs, your book about Polk. And it was just, it's an amazing book, and I learned so much from it. So it's really exciting for me to speak with you about your William McKinley book, your President McKinley book. Something interesting about thinking about Polk and thinking about McKinley, because you chose both of them for topics here. Polk was president at a particular time in American history of expansion and transition. And after reading your book, McKinley was as well. What were some of the similarities you saw in those two characters?
I think the greatest similarity is the fact that both of these guys were operating in America, and America is intrinsically and instinctively an expansionist nation, has been from the very beginning. And Polk exploited that, he channeled that, he pulled it together into expanding America by a third. And in doing so, he also sort of exacerbated the slavery issue, because the big fundamental question that couldn't be handled politically was, what are we going to do about slavery in those new territories that Polk had brought into America? So that basically interrupted America's expansionist impulse and expansionist push. So America had a civil war. It attempted to stitch the country back together as best as possible. It took decades to do that. It entered the industrial era in a big way. But didn't really think much about expansionism until about the 1890s, when the industrialization of America was producing tremendous wealth. American productivity was just outpacing every other country. And all of a sudden, it became clear to people in America that this expansionist impulse was now in a position to be dusted off and put forward. And that's how America went into the world. And it went into the world largely because of the policies of William McKinley. Now, I will say he wasn't a visionary in terms of seeing American greatness before anyone else could. TR gets credit for that. I think Senator Henry Cabot Lodge gets credit for that. Admiral Alfred Mahan gets credit. Not McKinley so much, but what McKinley could do was see events as they unfolded and mesh them together and move them in the direction that he favored.
He was a diligent, well-organized administrator, is kind of what I got from your book.
Right, and he was a bit of an incrementalist. He liked to keep everything under control, move it. He was kind of like a chess master. He would move his pieces on the board, always thinking about what the next move was going to be, what the opponent's move was going to be. He didn't like to move dramatically or boldly. But sometimes events became so hearty and so raucous that he had to move more boldly, and sometimes he wasn't as quick to do that as he actually needed to be. But generally, he was very effective as a manager.
It's interesting that you say that you note this about McKinley's personality, about him being, you know, a bit slow to move, because McKinley comes into the office at the time where the progressive movement in the United States, populism, is at a high point. And how does he manage, being someone who's slow to move, how does he manage to stay popular in an era where people wanted drastic change?
Well, the country was very split on that whole question. We had gone through the panic of 1893. It was a terrible recession, depression, as they said in those days, probably the worst other than the Great Depression. And it was particularly affected the rural people, the farmers in the West and the South. And they desperately wanted expanded liquidity because they felt that they couldn't get past the problems they were facing because they couldn't borrow money from the banks, and they needed more money in circulation. And so their answer was that what was called the free coinage of silver. Get silver out there, and that will expand the money supply, and we'll have the liquidity, and we'll be fine. Of course, the establishment people of the Northeast, particularly the bankers and others, and that was largely the Republican Party, basically said that's essentially debasing our currency, and we don't want to do that. We need to stick to a solid gold standard. And McKinley he had a certain humanitarian sentiment to him, and he cared about people a great deal. So he had kind of flirted with the free coinage of silver as a young man, and he had to decide how he was going to try to, you know, wend his way through this. And he ultimately decided that he was going to go for a strong gold standard position. And that's what he did. And because he was very adept at talking to the American people, and because he crafted that brilliant front porch strategy where 750,000 Americans came to him rather than him having to go to them, he managed to blunt the populist wave, the pro-silver wave, and then his success in his first term. He pulled the country out of the recession. He had tremendous economic growth. The country was humming again from an industrial standpoint. Productivity was just amazing. And so by that time, he basically managed to sort of take the sting away from the populist movement.
President McKinley's one of those Ohio presidents, of which we've had a few in our history. And Ohio these days, politically, we think of it as a swing state. You write in your book, Ohio politics resided on a knife's edge of parity between Republicans and Democrats. This is the end of the 19th century. Not much has changed, perhaps. Then you go on and discuss some of these political characters from Ohio from this period. Mark Hanna, Sherman, Foraker, Hayes. Let's talk for a minute about these. What was it about Ohio at that time period? And kind of give us a little bio on each of these great characters that you so well define in your book.
Well, I love these guys, and I have to say, I used to be a political reporter for the Wall Street Journal in my glorious youth, and I traveled around the country a great deal, and I always liked going to Ohio because it was such a political microcosm, and it kind of always was, largely because of its location. You know, the the expansion of America had immigrants moving across westward, across the country in bands. So you had the northeastern Massachusetts people moving across the top of the country and ending up in Oregon and Washington. You just notice that cities and towns have the same names in Oregon as they do in Massachusetts. In many cases, very, very interesting. But Ohio was sort of centrally located, and it was in that beautiful valley, and it drew people from the south and people more from the north and people straight from the east. And they all sort of came together. They had their own enclaves. But that created a kind of a yeasty political atmosphere in which much of what was going on in the country was also going on in Ohio. And it brought people who, first in agriculture, were very expansionist, hardworking. And then as the industrialization of America emerged, they moved into industry. And so we had the people that were coming to get jobs in industry, mostly immigrants from Italy and Eastern Europe and the Balkans, Croatia, et cetera. Then you had the old English and earlier German people who had, the Germans found themselves more easily assimilated into the Anglo-Saxon culture. So you had those two fundamental positions. And the Republicans were the party of the old elites, essentially, the people who came earlier and established themselves. And the Democrats were the party of the mostly the immigrants. So that's kind of how Ohio kind of emerged as being on kind of a knife's edge. But if you want, I can go into some of these characters because.
Please, yeah. Yeah, I think our audience would be, they would be able to find some equivalence mentally with the politicians of today. And also, they're so colorful. So why don't we start with John John Sherman?
And so you have to start with John Sherman. He was a generation ahead of the McKinleys and the Four Acres, not so much the Hayeses, but the McKinley's Four Acres and Mark Hanna. He was an amazing guy. He came from a wealthy family, but he was a rebel, and he was always getting into fights, and he got kicked out of school for punching one of his teachers. So he leaves the family at age 16, becomes a lawyer, becomes quite wealthy in his industrial pursuits and legal pursuits, fights in the Civil War. But he emerged as a very significant politician and a politician who was very, very much against slavery. He was an abolitionist. And he spent an entire long time career in Congress, and he was everywhere where the action was, there was John Sherman. He was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in the House. He was chairman of the Finance Committee in the Senate. He was chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee. He worked in every major issue that occurred before, during, and after the Civil War. He served as Rutherford B. Hayes's Treasury Secretary. He's famous for the Sherman Antitrust Act, which we still talk about. He was a bit of a brittle guy, and he got more so as he got older, and he wanted to be president. So pretty soon it became clear. I had an old friend, a longtime aide in Congress that I used to cover Congress, and he said, I asked him how his boss was getting along with Bob Dole, and he says, Bob Dole is running for president. You can't deal with anybody who's running for president. Well, that was kind of the same situation with John Sherman. He wanted to be president so bad that everything had to go through that prism, and he became sort of surly and difficult to deal with. So then you've got Mark Hanna. Mark Hanna was one of the great industrialists of America in that time, but certainly in Ohio. He was probably the richest man in Ohio. He had gotten into shipping and retailing and industrialization. He bought a newspaper. He owned a play theater, a playhouse in Cleveland. But he loved politics, and he loved politicians. And he decided that he wanted, now that he was rich, he wanted to work with politicians. He wanted to get Sherman into the White House, and he wanted to get an Ohioan into the governor's office. And the one he selected was Ben Foraker. Ben Foraker had a background much like McKinley's. He entered the Civil War at age 16. He ended the Civil War as a captain. McKinley entered the war at age 18 and ended the war as a major. Then he got into politics, not very successfully. He was from Cincinnati. Not very successfully. His first two or three efforts to get into politics ended in failure. But he finally ran for governor, and he lost. But he ran a very creditable campaign, and he emerged as a serious politician. Now, he made a big mistake because Hannah kind of fell in love with him. Hannah had a – it's kind of interesting because for somebody who was as accomplished as he had a kind of a hero worship side to him. And he just basically sort of fell in love with Ben Foraker, and he's writing him these fulsome letters, and I'm on your side, I don't want anything in return, and let me know, and hey, by the way, can you come to Cleveland for the weekend? We've got a wonderful place on the lake and everything. And Foraker took his support, but he didn't really respond in kind. And the result was that they ended up in a relationship that was kind of one-sided. And then they go to the convention, and this would have been, this would have been in 1888. And Foraker is supposedly supporting John Sherman for the Republican nomination for president. But Sherman's having trouble getting the votes, and Foraker abandons him. Well, Hannah couldn't stand that because Hannah's whole concept was loyalty, to your friends. He said, I always stand by my friends, whether they deserve it or not. So Hannah transferred his loyalty. He saw young William McKinley, and there was kind of a boomlet for McKinley, but he was a Sherman supporter. So he stood up on a chair in the convention, basically said, I will not allow anybody to put my name forward. I am loyal to my man, John Sherman. I came here to support him, and I intend to support him. And his stock rose significantly, and Hannah basically adopted him. And they forged this alliance that was very, very powerful politically and very powerful from a friendship standpoint.
Right before that, there's a scandal during the campaign, right? McKinley almost loses it because there's a scandal erupts. As I understood it, McKinley was kind of in a situation where he had to delicately decide how to handle that situation. It was during the campaign, correct, when that went down?
That happened when he was governor, and it happened before his first term as governor. He served two-year terms. And, yeah, it could have destroyed his career, though. I think it's worth talking about because it says something about McKinley, and I'm not sure I totally understand it, even though I've been following politics and politicians for a long time. He very unwisely signed these notes for a friend and supporter who found himself in a very terrible financial bind as a result of that panic of 1893 I talked about. So he kept signing these notes, and he'd get on the hook for it. It ended up being something like $130,000, which was a huge amount of money in those days, far more than he had. He had a lot of very close friends, and his friends really were devoted to him. They revered him. He was that kind of a person. And so they all got together, and they essentially bailed him out. They bailed him out by creating a fund. They took over all of his assets. There was a blind trust sort of a thing. And he paid into it for the rest of his life to sort of try to pay back these people. But you can see how a lot of people would say, well, these industrialists who bailed them out were people who have a lot of business affected by the government. He essentially sold out to these people.
It's a conflict of interest, right?
You think so? Yeah. But the American people kind of gave him a pass on that. And his opponents could never get it into any kind of political traction. So he managed to survive that, which could have destroyed his career. Very interesting that he could have easily gotten out of it by going into the law for a big railroad company or going to New York or Chicago. But he just didn't want to do that. He loved politics too much.
Once McKinley gets the nomination for the Republican Party,
he is able to campaign very effectively, and so effectively that, in fact, modern strategists like Karl Rove have gone back and looked at McKinley as, and his campaign, as models from which to draw valuable lessons. And I think Rove has been successful with it. What is it that is so valuable, and what is it so unique about McKinley's campaign that these modern strategists can find value in it?
Well, first of all, let me say that Karl Rove's book is a wonderful book. It's not a book about the McKinley presidency, but it's a book about the political era of McKinley and how he emerged in that 1896 campaign. And I think he gets it totally right. And I like to think that I do also, because politics in America for most of the time up until that period was based on the idea of total party loyalty. And so what you needed to do is you needed to sort of galvanize the base, as we say in today's world of politics. You need to get the people who are of your type excited. And that means like torchlight parades, and it means big festivals and picnics, and obviously there's speeches and there's rhetoric as well. But America was changing, and it was bringing in a lot of immigrants who were new residents. They were new citizens, and they didn't really know where they stood. And so it wasn't enough to galvanize the base, because you didn't know who the base was. You had all these people out there who were immigrants who hadn't really formulated their political sensibility, and you needed to capture them. And how do you capture them? Well, you're not going to do it with a torchlight parade. You needed to educate them in terms of your own view of the world and how it affects them. And it was Hannah who crafted this kind of very expensive, and he raised a huge amount of money, I think he had 10 times as much money as William Jennings Bryan, the opponent in the Democratic Party. But they crafted this approach of creating all kinds of brochures and papers and booklets and flyers with explanations and pictures and all the rest of getting stuff into newspapers, inserts into newspapers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there were like millions of pages of this stuff that went out into the country and had never been done before. And I think that it probably, and there was another factor here, which I need to mention, that is that, which we talked about before, that the country was sort of riven by this big split, over currency matters, gold standard versus silver, free coinage of silver. Well, that's a pretty esoteric issue. And a lot of people didn't fully understand it. They thought they did, especially in the farm sector, but they needed to educate people as to why it was important to think in terms of gold. And you had to sort of get into their heads, not just with the fiery rhetoric, but with explanation of why the gold standard was better, or in the case of William Jennings Bryan, why silver was necessary. But Bryan didn't have the money to do that kind of an educational campaign. So that's how, and partly how gold kind of prevailed.
And someone who helped with that was Charles Dawes, correct?
Charles Dawes was selected. He was just a young guy. He was brilliant and very interesting, and later became vice president under Coolidge. But William McKinley really almost adopted him as a son. I think it was the closest thing to a father-son relationship that McKinley ever had. He never had sons. He had two daughters. They both died very young. And so they were very, very close. But yes, Hannah, as he realized that this plan was going to require lots of money, and he was the only one who could really raise the money, he had an office in New York where he spent most of his time on the money-raising side. And he sent Dawes to Chicago, the headquarters in Chicago, and he ran all this operation of creating all these brochures and papers and newspaper articles, et cetera. And he was amazingly efficient. He was an industrialist. He'd gotten into banking. He was very successful in the utilities trade, and he made a lot of money at a very young age. And he was quite a brilliant and a sympathetic young fellow.
So the Republican Party that was there whenever McKinley was young, that he grew up in, that began in the 1850s and, is powerful through the 1860s and 70s, that party vastly expanded federal power. But by the 1920s, the GOP had become, the party of government downsizing. It had become the party with the general attitude towards government that it has today. How does McKinley's administration, how does his time in office, where does it fall within the spectrum? How did he contribute to creating the modern Republican Party?
Well, the modern Republican Party, the original Republican Party, was really the creation of Abraham Lincoln, because he was a man who sort of emerged as the great figure of the party very early on in its history. And Lincoln had demonstrated that he was not above tilting the power interrelationships of America in favor of the executive branch or in favor of the federal government. And I think that stayed with the Republican Party throughout most of the 19th century, the last half of the 19th century. Certainly Reconstruction was an episode in which the power of the federal government was brought to bear. Now the Republican Party abandoned Reconstruction with the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, McKinley's great mentor. But nevertheless, the Republican Party was the party of reform, the party of better race relations, although they didn't go very hard on that because the sentiment in the country wasn't there for it at the time. And generally more amenable to the idea of tilting power more towards the executive branch. But that was incremental, really, when you think about it, compared to what came later with Roosevelt and everything. But Teddy Roosevelt certainly represented that. He was a forerunner to his distant cousin Franklin. And I think that that had McKinley lived, I think that there was going to be more tilt. McKinley felt that he had to do something about the trusts, which Roosevelt did do in his inimitable way. And so I think that had McKinley lived and had Roosevelt succeeded him, and had Roosevelt then attempted to bring more power to the executive branch in favor of more regulation and more areas of life, I don't think there's any question that McKinley would have accepted that and probably supported it. But you're right. Something happened later. I think that, as you say, in the 20s, it became the party of government. In McKinley's day, there was an idea that you could actually be the party of industry, the party of business, and the party of labor. But that was becoming more and more difficult to do. And with Franklin Roosevelt, he just drove a wedge between capital and labor. And that was the end of that possibility.
So what was the personal dynamics between Roosevelt and McKinley?
Roosevelt was sort of the McKinley opposite. There's been very seldom have there been two people so far different. McKinley, the quiet adjudicator, the manages from the shadows. He makes people do what he wants them to do, and when they don't even know that he wants them to do it, he's quite the subtle manipulator. And Teddy, of course, who's this impetuous, flamboyant, bold talking man, practically obsessed with himself. His own kid said that he desperately wanted to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. But the interesting thing, and McKinley, when all of his, a lot of people, a lot of TR's friends were promoting TR for assistant naval secretary at the beginning of the first McKinley administration, McKinley was wary. He told one of his friends who was promoting Teddy Roosevelt, he said, "Your friend Teddy always seems to get into controversies with people. I don't think I want that in my administration." She says, no, he won't do that. He's learned his lesson. He wants to be calm." So he put him in the Navy Department as assistant Navy secretary under a former Massachusetts governor named John Long. And John Long discovered that he had to watch Teddy carefully because he never knew what he was going to do. He was going to start sending orders to ships all over the world and telling them to go here and coal up over there. And he had to tell him, you know, stop doing that. But the interesting thing is that McKinley liked him. McKinley liked to go on carriage rides in the afternoon to sort of get out of the office. He worked late at night, so he needed a little break. And he had various friends that he particularly liked to take on these carriage rides. His wife, Ida, is one, but others. But it turns out that he kind of enjoyed having TR because he was so voluble, and he would be, you know, chirping about every little thing and expressing great opinions and conviction about this and that, even small matters. And McKinley found him amusing. So they developed a pretty good friendship. And then, of course, when the war comes along with the Spanish-American War, Roosevelt does that amazing thing. He resigns the position in the Navy Department. He forms the Rough Riders. He becomes one of the great heroes, probably indubitably one of the two greatest heroes of the war, along with George Dewey, who destroyed the Spanish fleet in the Pacific at Manila Bay. And so he comes back. He parlays that into the governorship of New York. He's a man on the fast track, but the bosses of New York can't stand him because he doesn't play their game or pay their price. And he and they kind of try to want him to get out of there. And they think that the vice presidency may be the best possibility. And the fact is, he might have lost if he'd run for re-election as governor of New York. So he just takes he constantly says he doesn't want to be vice president. He won't take it. He won't accept it if offered. He doesn't want it. But he shows up at the convention in his Rough Rider hat. He, you know, goes to the headquarters hotel with his Rough Rider hat on. And you don't do that unless you're trying to get attention, right? Somebody's looked at him across the room and said, "That's a vice presidential hat if I ever saw one." So the convention goes wild and they want Teddy. But Mark Hanna hates Teddy. This guy's out of control. You can't trust him. You don't know what he's going to do. It's all about him. He's not loyal. And all that was true. And so Hanna sort of stands up and he's trying to thwart this boomlet that's emerging for Teddy to become the vice president, McKinley's first vice president in his first term. Garrett Hobart had died in office, so they had to find somebody new. And McKinley had to sort of, you know, pull Hanna's choke chain a little bit. He had to send him these messages saying, "Cease and desist. You're putting yourself in my behalf athwart the clear, wild sentiment of this convention. That's an untenable position for me. Please don't put me in that position and stop this." So the first time, Hanna was so intent on thwarting Roosevelt that he didn't really listen to his own boss and his friend. But ultimately, when he got the second message that was more harshly expressed, he stood down. And the convention, you know, just went wild for Teddy. So he got himself positioned to become president in just a few months thereafter. And I think he would have been president anyway, but I think it would have been better for the country and certainly for McKinley's reputation in history had he been able to serve out his second term. I think that if McKinley had served two full terms with all that happened in his watch and all that he brought about in his slow, methodical way, I think we would be looking at him as one of the great American presidents today.
That's a sentiment shared by Bruce Carlson, who we interviewed and spoke about this. Your book is titled President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. Could you explain what makes him the architect of the American Century?
Yeah, don't you think that's a rather audacious subtitle?
I love it. I love it. It's bold.
He's not viewed as that at all. And so it's designed to sort of get people to turn their heads and maybe they have dismissed it out of hand because this guy is viewed by many people as being somewhat maybe bland or, you know, not very flamboyant. But I think that if you look at his presidency carefully, you will see that while America was moving upward in terms of its economic power and its ambitions, its global ambitions, it was McKinley that really pulled all this together and took America into the world and created the American empire for good or ill and did a number of other things. And I'll just list them. He set in motion the actions, some of which were real impediments that he got out of the way, for the creation of the Panama Canal. He brought Hawaii into the American orbit through negotiation and annexation, whereas his predecessor had no interest in that. He maneuvered America. He wasn't anxious to get America into a war with Spain, but he wanted Spain out of the Caribbean, and he wanted to end that insurrection. He wanted Spain to end the insurrection that was bloodying up Cuba and destabilizing the entire Caribbean and harming the interests and the lives, threatening the lives of many Americans who were operating in the Caribbean. So he moved through diplomatic harshness towards a situation that was almost inevitably going to lead to war. And meanwhile, he's building up the Navy in case a war comes. Now, there are a lot of people who have a faulty view of McKinley who think that he just got dragged into the war. Well, that's not what happened. If you study that diplomacy with Spain, with Madrid, carefully, you see that he was putting them in a corner, and they in war as a result of that was going to be inevitable, and he knew it. And he knew it because he was fixated on one thing. He wanted Spain. He didn't want that dying imperial power in our backyard and in our Caribbean lake. And he knew that this destabilization in Cuba could bring in Germany or some other major European power, and that would be worse than having Spain there. So he did that, and as a result, he picked up the Philippines. He picked up Cuba temporarily. We gave them their independence very early, as we had promised to do. Picked up Puerto Rico. He picked up Guam. He established this special relationship with Britain. We almost went to war with Britain in the previous administration, the Cleveland administration, over a silly border dispute in South America. Created the so-called open door in China, which saved China from just getting carved up and destroyed as a nation, which was pretty much happening until John Hay created this open door concept, McKinley's Secretary of State. So all those things happened. Oh, and he also crafted this concept, and I don't know how consciously he did it, but he did do it intellectually, concept of non-colonial imperialism, which is the concept that Franklin Roosevelt kind of embraced as he was taking America into a much more powerful position in the world, the global superpower after World War II. All those things he did in terms of his foreign policy, and all those things created a foundation for America in the 20th century. And so that's why I say he was the architect of it.
So President McKinley was one of the four in our history who've been assassinated. Can you talk a little bit about how he met his end in Buffalo on that September afternoon?
Yeah, I can. And, you know, it's interesting. I may have the years not exactly right, but I think we had three presidential murders in 36 years, Lincoln and Garfield and McKinley. You can only imagine what the Americans were thinking about their country when they lose three presidents in little more than a generation. It's a pretty powerful development. But McKinley, he had a fatalistic view about any harm that could come to him from a malefactor. And he mingled with citizens and Americans very, very avidly, much more avidly than the Secret Service wanted. And he went to the famous Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, which was quite a thing. He gave a rousing speech on trade, free trade, again, an educational kind of speech on why he believed that his old protectionism and high tariff views needed to be modified a little bit as America expanded its ability to produce goods, both agricultural and industrial, and needed markets overseas because the American market wasn't sufficient for the kind of production that was going on. So he gave that speech, and then the next day he was going to go to the Hall of Music, and he was going to stand in the receiving line, and Americans were going to walk by and shake his hand. Well, this guy, Leon Czolgosz, decides that he's going to kill him. He's an anarchist. And, I never quite understand what the basis of anarchism is, but there were a lot of them in those days, and there were a lot of assassination attempts under those auspices. And so he gets in line, and he has his pistol hand kind of wrapped up in like a bandage. So McKinley reaches for the other hand and he puts the gun right to his chest and fires it. That bullet didn't get very far. It didn't penetrate very much, but then McKinley sort of instinctively dropped back on his heel. That put him about 2 feet away from Chalgaj, and he fired again and got right in, got a bullet into his abdomen. He was taken away for surgery, and they found that they couldn't find the bullet. They concluded that leaving it in was less dangerous than continuing to sort of probe around his innards.
Allow me to interrupt briefly, which is what they did with Garfield.
Yes, that's true. I think they basically botched it with Garfield. But in the case of McKinley, you have to say that the surgeons, based on their knowledge at the time, didn't do anything that was totally reprehensible from a professional standpoint. But he was actually doing quite well after the surgery, and they, you know, sewed him up, cleaned him up, sewed him up. But then in those days, infection was just such a huge problem. They didn't know how to combat it. And he developed a sepsis or infection. And so whereas he was coming back, looked like he was recovering fine, he took a turn for the worse and went straight downhill from there.
So Robert Mayer, you've now written two outstanding books in recent years. And you started out as a journalist. And now you're writing these killer history books. What inspired you to take your skills as a journalist and apply them to history?
Oh, I think I always saw journalism and history as being sort of in tandem. I grew up in Washington State, not a lot of history there, but I spent my third grade year. My dad was pursuing a PhD in English literature, and we went to Charlottesville, Virginia. And I learned, sort of got beguiled by history and all that Civil War and Thomas Jefferson and Monticello and statues and all the rest of it, many of which are coming down now, I might note. I always loved history from that moment, but my dad didn't get a PhD. He gave that dream up, and he went back to the Northwest here, where I am right now, and became a reporter at the newspaper in Tacoma, Washington, ultimately becoming managing editor of the paper. And I just loved that newsroom. It was like it was the nerve center of Tacoma. And as I got older and knew I wanted to be a journalist, I knew I wanted to be a journalist covering major historical events. So that got me to Washington for 40 years. And ended up reporting for the Wall Street Journal, mostly politics and Congress and White House and economic policy and all the rest of it. And then I wanted to become a manager, so I ran Congressional Quarterly, the publishing company, for a number of years until it was sold to The Economist of London. Along the way, it occurred to me that I could combine those great endeavors that I enjoyed so much with writing some history and some foreign policy tracks and whatnot, which I was very interested in. So I just got into it, and the more I did, the more I liked it.
That's amazing, and you're great at it.
You are great at it. I have one last question, if I may. Today, it seems like the parties may be in a period of realignment, the political parties in America. You have been a longtime observer of American history and politics. What are your impressions of the current state of American politics, and how do you see the two parties realigning?
Well, I'm not sure they are, but I will say this. My interpretation of what's going on in America today is that the country is in what I call a crisis of the old order. It's a status quo crisis. The status quo is no longer working. This happens. It happened. I have to say that the crisis of the old order line is not original to me. It was the title of Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s first book in his 3-volume series on Franklin Roosevelt. And the first one was Crisis of the Old Order. And if you go back and read that book, you sort of say, well, exactly, the politics just weren't working anymore. And the American people understood that, but the politicians are always the last to get it because they're so invested in the old order, in the way they've always done things, in the issues that they've been projecting and promoting for so long. And for quite a few number of years now, I've felt that we are in just exactly the same sort of a situation where the politics of old are no longer relevant to the problems and challenges and forces of today. And yet the parties are clinging ever more tenaciously because they're threatened in this cling, but ever more tenaciously to their old nostrums and their old ways of thinking. And that gets them more and more into deadlock because they're both clinging so avidly to those old ideas. And the only way we get out of that deadlock is like through, well, we have a presidential system. So it's going to take presidential leadership, and it's going to take the kind of presidential leadership that busts up the old fault lines and the old coalitions and creates a new coalition, putting together more disparate groupings, political groupings that haven't been put together before. And that's a tall order. And you have to have the vision, and you've got to have the ability to pull it off. And nobody seems to understand it, number one, or to be able to do it, number two. Here we are. And I think we will continue to be in this situation until we find ourselves with a president who understands it well enough to make a difference.
Robert, I said in a recent post, a recent Road to Now post, that I believe that American politics is in a state of mourning, that the Democrats are in the denial phase of grief, and that the Republicans are in the anger phase of grief, but we won't move forward until we come to acceptance.
Well, Robert, I'm not going to bother you about what you're working on now or what's coming next, but I hope that whenever it's finished and whenever it's released, you will come back on the Road to Now and discuss it with us, because we'd love to have you.
Well, I will. I wouldn't miss it. This has been most enjoyable, and I don't have a project right now. I'm sort of weighing some ideas, but when I get there and I get to completion, you guys can expect to have me back if you have me.
Oh, we'd love to.
We look forward to it. We always will. Thank you. Have a great day.
La Cosecha Coffee Roasters provides fresh roasted coffee grown in a sustainable manner where the farmer is given a fair price, which means the coffee goes straight from the harvest to your cup. The best part? You can get 10% off your next purchase by using the promo code RTN1010 at checkout. Visit lacosechacoffee.com. or follow the links at theroadtonow.com.
The Road to Now is hosted by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. It's produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scott. Our intern is Megan Summers. We'd like to say a special thanks, as always, to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout-out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, and Jeff LeCain. We'd also like to thank our newest Lincoln Tier member, Nicholas Greenfield. As always, we thank you for what you do on Patreon, and if you want to get some new episodes, and in return for supporting the podcast, check us out, patreon.com/theroadtonow. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us spread the word. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care.
Osiris. This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.
Hey guys, if you're a fan of The Road to Now, then be sure to check out Nashville Public Radio's newest podcast, The Promise. They've spent the last year reporting from the city's largest public housing complex, getting to know the people who live there, the officers who police the neighborhood, and the city officials who want to give it the overhaul of a lifetime. It's a dramatic story told in six parts, and the first episode includes a great overview of the history of public housing in the U.S.
So check out The Promise for free on Apple Podcasts or at WPLN.org.